Welcome to Update One, the podcast of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Update One provides a forum for listeners to learn about national stories focusing on news, politics, and current events. Now, the latest edition of Update One.
I'm Adam Cano on location at the Biennial Paris Air Show, aviation's largest industry event. I'm joined here in the press center by Thomas Withington, a Toulouse-based aerospace and defense journalist. Tom is editor of two trade publications, Armada International and Asian Military Review. Tom, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Adam. Good to be here.
Before we talk about your publications, help our listeners understand where you and I are this week. What exactly is going on here at Le Bourget Airport on the outskirts of Paris?
Well, we're at certainly Europe's and possibly the world's biggest air show. And really, this is where the industry, where its customers, where its clients, where the media, where politicians, where anyone really with a deep interest in aviation and space come to congregate, discuss, share ideas, see new products, and appreciate new technologies.
Yeah, to paint the picture, it's literally sort of a city, right? We've got six exhibition halls behind us, a couple hundred corporate, what are called chalets, where business meetings are happening, and then in between here at the press center, a large static display of dozens of aircraft of all sizes.
I'd say we're probably looking just from here, we're probably looking easily at several hundred million dollars worth of aviation hardware sitting in front of us, not to mention the flying displays that we have in the afternoon every day.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Armada International and Asian Military Review. How are they distributed in print and digital formats, and who are your readers?
Our core readers really are everybody from, I always tell people, from the soldier on the front line to the politician in their office to the executive in their boardroom. We go right from foxhole to office at the end of the day, and everybody and anyone really with an interest in defense looks at our publications. Regarding Armada, we look at defense procurement and military technology around the world. We look at the strategic and the operational picture of what's happening in conflict and how that then translates into the equipment that the military buy and also the equipment that is developed to serve those needs. Asian Military Review performs a similar role, but we really focus very heavily on the Asia-Pacific region within that. So we look obviously very closely at what countries like China are doing, also what Japan is doing, Australia, the other major players around the region, and the security challenges that they have therein.
Other than the geographic focus, is there any sort of noticeable difference in sort of tone and style, or is it really, you know, pretty straight regardless?
It's a very good question. I think in terms of style, we probably focus a little bit more on the strategic, I suppose you could say the politico-economic situation in Asian Military Review, certainly regarding the Asia-Pacific region. In terms of the tone of both publications, we've always strived really to have, to be informative, to be respected publications, but equally to have a conversational style. It's very important for me as editor that anybody who picks up the magazine, they don't have to be an expert in defense, just somebody perhaps with an interest, can still understand and appreciate the subjects that we talk to. So we try not to patronize our readership, work very hard on that, and we try to keep things conversational and light in tone as much as we can.
Like a lot of trade publications, you use a fair number of freelancers to help supplement the coverage that you provide. How does that work, and how many of your stories are assigned out by you versus, you know, pitched up as enterprise journalism from the freelancers you work with?
We typically commission most of our major articles at the beginning of each year. We write the editorial program usually around this time of year, so June, July, August time, and then we look at commissioning around October, towards the end of the year, and we program in all of the feature articles for the next year. Now, what we do within that is obviously the news agenda changes, so we tend to commission certain subject areas, and then we allow the writers a fair bit of leeway within that for them to talk about the issues or the developments that are important. Regarding freelancers really are the lifeblood of Armada and Asian Military Review. We're utterly dependent on them, and we're also incredibly lucky that, and I feel incredibly privileged as editor, to work with some of the people I consider the very best in their field and people who are extremely well respected in the defense community. So that's a hugely important part of what we do. It's also a hugely important part of our online presence as well.
why are trade shows like the Paris Air Show important, and how do you approach a show like this from an editorial perspective, given that there are thousands of exhibitors here? It's, you know, more than a mile from one end of the show to the other. It goes on for days. You know, how do you sort of approach that strategically so that you get what you need as a journalist out of this week?
I would say, to quote, I think it was Eisenhower who once said, to plan is to be foolish, but planning is indispensable. And I apologize if I'm paraphrasing horribly there. So, and I think that applies to a show like this. I think from a journalistic perspective, if you came without a plan and just say, right, I'm just going to try and speak to as many companies as I can, or try and see as many things as I can, you'll have a very exhausting time, and you might find that you don't get as much out of it as you can, simply because there is so much. The way Armada and AMR approach it is always to do a lot of planning before the show, to really decide, look at the people we need to speak to, the contacts that we need to keep alive, and the new contacts we need to make, and to plan the show accordingly to ensure that we get the maximum we can out of it for 3 days. For example, my speciality is I look at defense electronics a lot. That's my thing. So I know that there's about 20, 25 companies and organizations I have to speak to, and I try and plan those appointments several weeks in advance and see as many people as I can. Why it's important is it really acts as a meeting place for the community. There's not much of an opportunity that I suppose the aerospace and defense family across the world has to get together, and this is an invaluable opportunity. And so as much as meeting companies and talking to organizations about what they're doing, it's also an invaluable opportunity to shake people's hands, to ask how they're doing, you know, even if it's just walking past somebody very quickly in the corridor. Those few seconds are very important. They keep relationships alive. And if you wanted to sum up why this show is important, I would say it's that word. It's relationships, ultimately.
Yeah. So, sadly, terrorism has been in the news a lot lately, here in France, across the channel in the UK, elsewhere in Europe. Even in Toulouse, where you're based, there was an incident a while ago. How do you think those incidents are covered in terms of mainstream and trade media compared to what you know about security writ large?
I think in the trade media, any sort of acts of political violence, certainly in my neck of the woods, so to speak, is always looking at how that then affects the procurement or the decisions that government takes about the military hardware or the security hardware that they then invest in, and obviously offsetting that with available budgets and whether governments have the required resources and the money to spend on things. There's always that uneasy relationship between what governments would like their armed forces to have and what they can afford. So I think from the trade perspective, that's one of the big things and one of the big influences that these kind of actions have. In terms of the general media, speaking of somebody who remembers the years of the IRA being very active in the UK, my memory of that is that the way these acts have been reported has changed hugely, because one of the interesting things is, if you look statistically, I saw some figures, I think, the other week in The Economist that said actually individual acts of political violence, there's a lot fewer of them now actually in Europe than there were when people like ETA or the IRA or the Red Brigade or Baader-Meinhof were doing these things. We can remember the years of the 1970s in Europe, what that was like, and terrorism was a very immediate, very visceral thing. But what we didn't have then was, we didn't have the kind of the 24-hour news coverage, we didn't have social media then. So people's exposure to it, I think, was different in a way. Their exposure to a terrorist act, if you like, was the main story on the evening news that night when they came home from work. Today it's on your smartphone, it's people going onto Facebook, clicking that they're okay, they're safe. So in some ways, we're in Europe, probably in the US as well, in some ways we're still as remote from it as we were, but at the same time we're still more connected with it because of the vectors, if you like, that news has available to make us aware of them.
Here in France we have a new president, Emmanuel Macron. He was actually here at the show yesterday. What do we know so far about his priorities for NATO and other things that impact aerospace and defense?
Very good question. I think it's still very early days, obviously. We've just had the parliamentary elections this previous weekend. My gut feeling is that he is very committed to ensuring France continues to play a very important role in NATO, plus a very important role around the world in helping to combat ISIS, helping to fight radicalization, if you like, both at home and abroad. And I don't really see that changing, and I think he will be a good champion of the aerospace and defense sector. It's a very important sector for France. It's a very important sector for the economy as a whole and for Europe's economy. And that's another interesting thing about Macron, is he is deeply committed to the European Union. So what I expect is him to push forward more of an agenda to reinforce European cooperation, both operationally in defense and at the industrial level.
Good job talking over the helicopter landing in front of us here, hopefully.
Occupational hazard.
He'll get below the chalets in a minute. So speaking of NATO and other things in terms of security, President Trump was here recently for a NATO summit, created some news by what he said and did, but also, you know, what he didn't say, which at the time was to clearly reinforce the importance of Article 5, the underlying notion that an attack on one is an attack on all. From your perspective here in Europe, how was the that NATO summit and President Trump covered?
I would say, firstly, and this is just from my perspective, I would say President Trump is not hugely popular in Europe, I think, is certainly in Western Europe, would be the first thing. So to an extent, that does affect and that does shape how he is covered. There is a great concern, certainly in Europe, that the US will remain committed to NATO, particularly regarding Russian activity on the eastern flank of Europe. Although, to be fair to the United States and to be fair to the Trump administration, I've not seen any indications at this current time to point that US commitment could diminish, and I don't necessarily see it doing so at the moment. I think one of the interesting effects that his presidency will have is I think it will make certainly the European Union keener to collaborate on defence, because I think, although I don't expect the US commitment to change, I think Europe was certainly spooked by initial things that Mr. Trump said, and I think that could translate into, well, hey, you know, we need to make sure that we are well defended as a continent by working together, by collaborating more. I think the commitment to NATO will stay, that won't change, but I think the EU will maybe, particularly with Britain out of the picture, I mean, with Brexit occurring, Britain's always been very reticent to increase European defence cooperation, and with 2019, when the UK leaves, that roadblock is removed. So I think that's one effect that you could see over the long term of the Trump presidency.
Last question. You've covered this industry for quite a long time and come to a lot of events like this. How do you sort of see the evolution in recent years in covering aerospace and defense, as you deal both with companies and with, you know, government officials, and is there a regional difference, or have the changes that you've noticed over time, you know, been pretty universal in different parts of the world?
I think, yes, there are certain trends I've seen on a global level. When I went into this industry, it was still about people buying aeroplanes and helicopters. That was the big thing. How many aeroplanes is country X going to buy? What will they announce at Paris? Certainly on the military sphere, I think that's changed hugely now. Typically, as we look forward over the next 20 to 30 year time frame, the number of platforms, as we call them, the number of helicopters and jets that are bought will become fewer, and aircraft will remain in service for longer. What that's meant in the industry is that the important thing now, or the thing that people look at very closely, is what goes on those aeroplanes, what weapons, what systems, what sensors, what equipment do those aircraft get fitted with? And really, that is emerging now as the big market, because you might keep a fighter plane in service for 40, 50 years, but you will have to update it, you will have to change it regularly. You could use the analogy of having a car. You know, you could maybe keep an Oldsmobile on the road for however long it's possible, but you'll need to get new brakes, you'll need to get a new engine, you'll need to change the car as it goes through. The body will stay the same, but what's underneath it will be different. And I see that definitely happening certainly in the defense aerospace world.
Tom, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Adam.
Tom Withington is editor of Armada International and Asian Military Review. You can follow Tom on Twitter at Chain Home High, CHAINHOMEHIGH. For Update One, I'm Adam Cano.
You have been listening to Update One, a production of the National Press Club's Broadcast Committee. You can comment on this show or any episode of Update 1 by going to facebook.com/PressClubDC or on Twitter @PressClubDC. Thanks for listening to Update 1.